I said then that if I lived long enough, it would be not only my pleasure, but your pleasure as well, at hearing a man with a fantastic message. I've waited 2.5 years to say, here's Virgil.
Thank you, Les. And how are y'all? I want to thank Les and his committee and his group for granting me the privilege of participating in this anniversary with you tonight. And also, I understand, in a first birthday, which is all so much important. I think Les has done a lot of talking about me, and it makes me feel, being up here, a lot like Zsa Gabor's sixth husband. I know what I'm here for, but can I make it interesting? My name is Virgil Warren. I am a member of the Decatur Group in Decatur, Georgia, and a sober alcoholic. Sober by the grace of God and through the instrument that He chose to grant me this sobriety. That is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I love the connotation of those words, sober and alcoholic. It always reminds me of a story that I love to tell. So if you've heard it, please don't try to stop me. Seems there were two girls who had been real chums in college, and they had graduated and followed the pattern of life, had married and started their own life, and had lost contact with each other. Finally, they ran into each other on a shopping tour in town one day, and very delighted to see each other. And they found that one of the girls had a little boy about 12 or 13 years old, and the other one had a daughter about the same age. And the lady that had the little boy lived out in the country on a farm. The other one lived in the city. And they wanted to get together one Sunday and reminisce over old times and talk about it, so the country girl invited a friend out to the farm, and everything was being readied for this Sunday. And finally, the lady called her little boy to her, and he says, "Son," said, "this is an old friend of mine. We want to spend an enjoyable evening together. You realize that we are Protestants. And this lady and her daughter that are coming out are Catholic. I don't want anything brought up about religion while they're out here this Sunday." And the little boy promised. And the day went along very uneventful until late in the afternoon, and the little boy became restless. And he asked the little girl if she'd like to go swimming. And he says, she says, "I didn't bring a bathing suit with me." He says, "out here in the country, we don't wear bathing suits. We just take our clothes off and throw them over the bushes and swim in the creek." So they went down to the creek and took the clothes off, threw them over the bushes. The little boy turned around and he looked at the little girl. He said, "You know, I never knew how much difference there was in a Catholic and a Protestant." And you know there are differences in alcoholics. I look back in my story, which is mine and mine alone. Now I'd add that any opinions that I may express here tonight, I learned them and acquired them through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And depending on where you stand, it seems like a long, long time ago, and yet a short time ago, that I sat on the back row of the Decatur group of Alcoholics Anonymous, very indignant guest at an AA meeting. I didn't want to belong there. I didn't belong there. Maybe these people were alcoholics, but I wasn't. I think I indicated in my inventory my first sign of insanity sitting on that back row. Because as I was indignant about being an alcoholic, I sat and listened to a speaker that I thought was lying and bragging and stretching the truth. And yet at the same time, I was saying to myself, I can top anything that guy's told. And I could have. My wife kept me going to those meetings. And I'd sit back and look over this crowd and I'd listen to these speakers. And I still thought they were lying and bragging. I couldn't understand why they would lie and be like this. It seemed like that every one of them got up there and said, I'm from a good Christian family. And I had to have an answer to that statement. And about the only thing I could come up with was that Christians just weren't very adept at raising children. And I said, if they ever ask me to talk in this organization, I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to tell them that we had good Christians in our family. We had alcoholics in it, and we had nuts in it. And I turned out to be one of the alcoholic nuts. Now, my mother was one of those good Christians. She was a very devout Methodist. That had we children in Sunday school and church every Sunday, and any other occasion that the church had. And I look back many years at a small boy sitting beside my mother's chair and having her read to me of Peter and Luke and John. And to have this mother impart to me her ambitions and her dreams, until these dreams and ambitions became mine. My mother wanted her eldest son to be a Methodist minister. This became my dream and my ambition. And I lived this way on up until I was 17 years old in high school. Suddenly, I began to notice that the boys and girls didn't invite me to their parties and to their dances. And they even referred to me as a panty waist. And it hurt deeply because I wanted to be accepted by these people. And I couldn't understand being a panty waist. I played on the football, baseball, and basketball teams, and how could a panty waist be an athlete? But nevertheless, they did, and nevertheless, it hurt. Till one night at a dance in Atlanta, I noticed these boys and girls ever so often between the dances would run out to their automobiles. And when they came back, they seemed to be laughing and smiling and happier than they were when they went out there. So I followed some of them out to their car one night. And these boys and girls were drinking corn whiskey and straight alcohol and chasing them with Coca-Colas and ginger ale. Now, I might tell you here now, if you get confused over my story a little bit, I'm 58 years old. The reason there's not too many gray hairs in my head is because they became pickled in alcohol before they had a chance to turn gray. But I walked out to this car and stood watching these boys and girls, and I told one of the boys to give me a drink of that. And he handed me a bottle of corn whiskey and a Coca-Cola. And I took my first drink at the age of 17, standing beside this automobile. Now, I've heard a lot of speakers in discussion meetings and standing from rostrums such as this say that they became an alcoholic 3, 4, 5 years before they came to this program. And that's their privilege and their opinion. Now, I don't want to get any controversy with them about it. But I believe that they are speaking of compulsive alcoholism or pathological alcoholism. I believe that I became an alcoholic when I took that first drink standing beside that automobile. And the reason I say that is because I have learned from you people that when anything becomes important in our lives, whether that thing be good or bad, it becomes a primary purpose, a driving force in our life. And alcohol had become important to me. From that point on, when I was invited to a party, I wanted to know where the party was going to be and who was going to be there. If there wasn't going to be any drinking, I didn't want to go. That is not the thinking of a normal person. Many times I recall the boys would say, "Virgil, let's run down to Athens to the University of Georgia. See the football game Saturday." My first question, who's going? And I didn't want to go unless it was a drinking crowd. I learned after coming into the program of AA that thousands of people go down to Athens on Saturday to see Georgia play a football game. Normal people do. So my actions were following the dictates of the cunning, baffling alcohol for the beginning. It was guiding my life. I was following. I continued on through high school till about 2 months before I was to graduate. Finally, it dawned on me one day, "Virgil, you're going to graduate from this high school in a couple of months. And then next September, you are going off to theology college. Become a Methodist minister." And I had to make a decision at the age of 17. And I weighed this God of mine on one hand and a bottle of liquor on the other. And I looked at this God, and in him I saw responsibility. I had to accept this God as the partner in my life. I had to make an example of myself for my congregation and for my community. And I looked at this bottle of liquor in the other hand. And to me, it was the easy way out. This way, I could manage my own life. So this bottle of liquor outweighed my God. When I graduated from school that year, another boy and I ran away from home. I didn't know what it was then. I know now I was running from responsibility. We ran all out through Texas and into Mexico and wound up in Long Beach, California. When something told me just before Christmas that year, Virgil, go home. I didn't know then what it was. I know now. And I went back home and was accepted in my home as if I had gone down to the corner grocery store after a loaf of bread. And life took up where it had left off. But then in February, I knew what I had been called home for, because this wonderful mother who loved me so much passed away. And I can look back now and see a sense of relief. Not at my mother's death. Now I don't have to be a minister. Already this was mother's dream. This was her ambition and not mine. And I felt relieved. But in August of that year, my father called me to him and told me we had to go to town to buy some clothes that go off to school in September. And I resented him. I learned my first resentment, and I resented him. Couldn't believe that my dad wanted me to be a minister. He was a young man, and I chose to believe that he wanted to get rid of me. Nevertheless, in September, off to theology college, I went. I was in theology college almost a year when I came home one weekend. When I got ready to go back late one Sunday afternoon, I told myself, and if you think this is not alcoholic thinking at the age of 18, just think how many times you've said it. I said, Virgil, you're working awful hard in that school and you run down and a drink would stimulate you. You're not sleeping well and a drink would help you sleep better. You're not eating well and a drink would stimulate your appetite. I went by a bootlegger and bought a fifth of whiskey to carry back to school with me to stimulate me. And that night, I did exactly what an alcoholic would do. I got drunk and caused a disturbance in the dormitory. And the dean came down and saw the situation and very wisely merely told me to be in his office at 10 o'clock the next morning. I came to this old man's office, and he chewed me out very well, like he should have done. And at the end of his conversation, he looked at me and he said, Virgil, I should expel you from this college where you couldn't attend another college in the state of Georgia. But due to your record, I'm going to give you an opportunity to resign. That old man didn't know he was talking to a budding alcoholic. And I asked him what it was in my record that would cause him to do such a thing. He said, to my amazement, you're leading your class in college. Now, what else but an alcoholic would lead his class in a theology college and go off and get drunk? But my alcoholism, my egotism was whetted. And I can remember going on my way home as if it was yesterday, and I've gone over this many times. I thought to myself, my God, what kind of professors does the Methodist Church have in their employ? Here I am, a young man at their own admission, could have been the greatest minister that denomination had ever known, and they asked for my resignation. And then I wanted to know, what kind of a God did I have? Here was a young man that was willing to sacrifice his life, go out into the world and to preach his gospel. And he let this happen to me. Already other people were interfering, and God was letting me down. And I want to throw in here that life's greatest tragedy is when we lose God and don't even miss him. And this was the beginning of mine. And I knew my Bible well. Why did these men, why did God do this to me? When 31st Proverbs, the 7th verse, says, go out into the world and get drunk and forget your troubles and sorrows. Now, you drunks didn't know that was in there. You can't get a better excuse than the Bible telling you to do it. When I came to this program, I was quite amazed at this living a day at a time. And yet I know now from my inventory that I had been living at a day at a time for years. I didn't care what happened yesterday or was going to happen tomorrow. I was merely concerned with today, to take care of the situation today. And all of we alcoholics can find excuses to take care of those situations. And we pick out things to cover up those situations, and overlooking any and everything around it. Because the verse after that one in Proverbs, the 8th verse says, if you are intent on self-destruction. That didn't count. I left that school and I came on back to Atlanta and entered Georgia Tech. I think now that I entered Georgia Tech just to prove to people that Virgil had it. I was beginning the proving stage now. I thought I was proving things to other people, but I was proving them to me. I entered Georgia Tech, and after being there, I left, went to work for one of Georgia's larger corporations. And in 18 years, I had built myself up in this corporation to become assistant to the president in charge of production and engineering. You know, speaking of those 18 years, each and every one of us, it varies, but we have a given time at which we can be successful in our life in spite of a bottle of alcohol. And I want to emphasize that word, in spite of. I have never seen or known anyone successful with a bottle of alcohol. So 18 years were mine. And at the end of those 18 years, there came a time that this corporation was going to elect a new president. And we had a board of directors meeting. The chairman of the board made two pointed statements directly to me, and they ran off of my back like water off of a duck's back. Someone asked him who the next president was going to be. And he said, well, I'm going to wait 6 months to see what happens. And another ambitious man in that room said, well, who do you think it will be? And he said, well, it will be Virgil if he hands his cigars out in the proper manner. I got up and walked out of that board of directors meeting and went out for the next 6 months to celebrate the fact that I had become president of that corporation. And I was sitting in my office one morning when my secretary came in and said, Mr. Warren, the chairman of the board wants to see you in his office. And I knew what he wanted. So I got up and put my coat on and straightened my tie. And I walked upstairs to accept the presidency of this corporation. And when I walked through the door, this fine, kindly old man was sitting behind his desk with tears running down his cheeks. And he looked up at me and he said, Virgil, I had hoped and I had prayed. It wouldn't be necessary to say this to you, but I must ask for your resignation. And that's how I became president of that corporation. I used to tell this part of my story a little different. But I know now, as I stood before that man, that I was sick in my stomach. Sick in my heart. I was about to die. And yet, unknowingly, I had begun to build that shell around me where nobody could touch me. Nobody could see how I felt. And I looked that man straight in the eye and I said, well, who did you name, President? And he told me, and I said, well, that is fine. Because if you had fired that man, he would have starved to death. I can make more money than your presidency calls for, and I'll prove it to you. Here again, I'm going to prove that you were wrong. Not me. You made a mistake. Not me. Little did I know that the beginning of the end was not far away. As I went out on the road covering the 7 southeastern states as a manufacturer's agent, and for that first 2 years that I was on the road, I was successful. I was participating in my swan song and didn't know it. And at the end of 2 years, I was making more money than his presidency called for. I called him up one day and told him I wanted to talk to him, and he was very delighted and told me to come over to his office. And I went over there and very vehemently laid those papers on his desk. I said, see there, you were wrong. And this proves it. Little did I know that proved it. That was my swan song. In traveling over my territory, there wasn't a person on the face of this earth that could have told me any different. And that I had to take my customers out and wine them and dine them. That I had to carry them to nightclubs and bars and taverns. And finally, I had a rude awakening It wasn't long till when I would go into these towns and night would come and I'd ask these men to go out that they'd have something else to do. They were not drinking with me, I was drinking with them. I was getting drunk. I was making an ass out of myself everywhere they went, and they wanted no more part of it. So they excused themselves. Then left me to what is, I know, is the loneliest life in the world for an alcoholic. Sitting in the room, sitting between four walls, drinking by myself. You see, I didn't even like to drink in bars anymore, because I knew those boys sitting at the bar with me would get up in the morning and go to work. And I couldn't make it, and I didn't like it. So I sat alone and drank and looked at those four walls and learned how to hate, learned how to despise people and to resent people. And then the blackouts and the hallucinations began. I think it nothing but fair that I tell you people now that I asked a doctor friend of mine one time how many blackouts you had to have before it affected your mind. And he told me three. So from this point on, for your benefit, you are listening to a blithering idiot. Only God would know how many times I got up out of a hotel bed, dressed, packed, checked out, and drove 200 or 300 miles and waked up in another hotel and not remember leaving the last. And then the music. I was constantly plagued with music. I even got to the point that I could drive down the road in my automobile listening to hillbilly music and get tired of it and reach over and push the button on the radio and change it to classical music, and the radio wasn't even on. I didn't know what was happening to me. I know now. I was running scared. I was afraid. And I sat in these hotel rooms and tried to find out what was wrong with Virgil, and the answer wouldn't come. I talked to God, and he wasn't any help. I planned and thought everything that could come about. I was an alcoholic, and I was the only person on the face of the earth that could do anything about it, and I didn't know how. It reminds me of the story of the traveling salesman who came down from his hotel room one morning and walked up to the desk clerk, and he slammed his suitcase down on the floor. He said, "Oh, buddy boy, this is the last time I ever spend the night in your hotel." The clerk said, "Well, sir, what's the matter?" And he said, "Well, I didn't sleep a wink last night, not one wink." The clerk said, "Well, sir, what was the problem?" He said, "Well, there was a dizzy blonde that was beating on my door all night long last night." The clerk said, "Well, sir, why didn't you get up and see what she wanted?" He said, "I knew what she wanted. She wanted out." This is what I wanted. I wanted out. And I didn't know where to turn. I was a 42-year-old child. And I wanted with all my heart to run back to my mother and get down at her chair and say, "Mother, your little boy is lost. Won't you please tell him what to do?" But you know, we can't run back home to mother anymore. This is our problem This was my problem. I knew only one thing, that back home I had a keeper. And I felt that I could run back home to this keeper. She would take care of me, and I'd be safe within the four walls of that home. Now, you can show me any alcoholic in the world, and I won't have to look around far to find his keeper. Each and every one of us have somebody we can run to when everybody else is through. So I went back home to what I thought was safety. But I went back home to live 3 years of hell on earth. Fear. Afraid. God only knows how many times that I have waked in my bed at night and looked out into the darkness, afraid of what was out there, yet sweating and shaking and wanting to know what was out there because I was afraid. Nothing could get me out of that bed but cunning, baffling alcohol. When the compulsion became so great, fear or no fear, I had to throw my legs over the side of that bed and go to the kitchen for a drink. And sometimes when I'd go to that kitchen and there wouldn't be a drink there, it would be all gone. And I'd come back and wake my wife up and curse her out for taking the last drink out of the bottle. Look at my watch, and it'd be 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. And then go to pacing that floor like the wild animal that I was. Stinking, smelling, hadn't changed clothes or taken a bath or shaved maybe in a 2 or 3 weeks. Pacing back and forth like a caged animal, holding my arms up, saying, God, how can you do this to me? This great Virgil that was going to conquer the world without God or without anybody was now a stinking, shriveling coward. And everybody knew it but me. How many times I've gone into my little boy's bed at night, sat on the side of his bed and cried till tears would run off of my face down onto his. And he'd wake up and look up at me, and I'd say, Chuck, your daddy's not going to take a drink in the morning. And have this boy looking at me and say, yes, Daddy, I know. He knew his daddy had to get up in the morning and take a drink. He knew better than I. Then along about this time is when the knocks began on the door. My family, my wife's family, the preachers, all of them wanting to help us, all of them loving us and wanting to do something, but they didn't know how. And in my opinion, they were sticking their nose in our business. Meddlers. And then the preachers would come, the men of the cloth, bless their hearts, and they'd come in and sat many a time on my settee and talked to me about God, to tell me that I needed faith, to tell me that I needed to believe in God, I needed to go to church, and I needed to pray. These wonderful men didn't understand. They didn't know that Virgil didn't have anything left to pray with. They told me that I needed to get down on my knees and pray. I have learned since I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't have any place to get down from, to get on my knees. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that I had to get up on my knees. It wasn't very far. But you know, there was one person that did understand, and that one was God. God knew that if Virgil was ever going to find sobriety, that he was going to have to create one of his miracles. And he did. Because there was a knock on our door one Sunday about noon. And when I opened that door, there stood a man and a woman that Margaret and I used to drink with. They had gotten so far down in the barrel that even Margaret and I had quit associating with them. But there they stood this Sunday morning, clean, dressed up, like they were going to church, and they were. And they came into the room and they sat down and they told us that they had joined the Decatur group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had been sober for 2 months, and they wished so much that we would go with them. And my wife is much more gullible than I was. She fell for that bunch of hogwash they were dealing out. And she got up and dressed and went with them. And she hasn't had a drink from that day till this. And each Thursday night and each Sunday afternoon when she'd come back from those meetings, I'd be sitting in my drunk chair. And I'd look up at her and I'd say, "Well, how are your drunk friends tonight?" She would just look at me. And another favorite remark was, "Well, how are all those drunks you're associating with over there?" And she wouldn't answer. Finally, about 2 or 3 weeks after that, this man came back one Sunday noon. And he said, "Virgil, I'm going to chair my first meeting at Decatur this Sunday afternoon, and I sure do wish you would go and be there." My curiosity told me to go. I wanted to find out who my wife was associating with. But my remark to this man and to Margaret was, "If he thinks it will help him, I'll go." And that's where I found myself sitting on the back row of the Decatur group, criticizing. I went to AA for 2 months, staying sober a week or two and getting drunk for a week or two and sober 10 days and drunk 10 days. But there was one thing I got from it. Being a brilliant person, being a genius, I discovered that evening, "Virgil, you have got a wealth of knowledge of alcoholism in the palm of your hand. If you'll just wake up and listen and pay attention, then you learn how to drink. Just don't do what they did." And I stayed sober the entire month of January. And I listened to these people. I heard what they said. And on the 1st of February, I got up one morning and I went to the DeSoto Hotel there and I went down to the Sapphire Room and I bought myself 2 bottles of beer and I drank it. I had me a good dinner. And I went upstairs with a magazine and got in the bed and I read. And long about 10 or 10:30, I was congratulating myself very highly. I said, see there, Virgil, those people were wrong about that one drink. You've had two. And you're up here like a normal person reading a magazine. You know what to do now. You can handle it. Tuesday, I worked hard all day, and I came in Tuesday night, and I changed those two beers for three vodka martinis. I had a good dinner, bought me another magazine, and went back to bed. And I got up Tuesday night and dressed and went back to the Sapphire Room for a nightcap. And then Friday night, there was some knocks on my hotel room door. I didn't know who was there, but I was getting very lonely by now. And I opened the door, and there stood two men. I've never seen them before in my life, but I invited them in. I wanted somebody to talk to. And they introduced themselves to me as Fred and Cornel. Two wonderful men that I will love till the day I die. And I will always hold dear in my heart. These men may be able to do something I don't like. They may do many things that I don't care for, but they can never have the capability of keeping me from loving. These two men were from the Savannah group of Alcoholics Anonymous and became my sponsors away from home. I didn't know what had happened, but the telephone wires had been busy between Atlanta and Savannah. And these two men were sent up there to keep me from leaving. And my eventual sponsor came after me. They stayed there, one of them, all Saturday night, Fred did, and practically all day Saturday. My sponsor, Russell, came in late Saturday afternoon. And he went down and he paid my bill at the hotel and checked me out and packed my bag, and we headed back to Atlanta. And I know that this is one of the first real lessons that I learned from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That somebody cared something about me. That at least Russell did. Here was an alcoholic Presbyterian minister that made a round trip of 550 miles to get a drunk out of a hotel that he hardly knew. And he had to preach a sermon Sunday morning in his church. And I couldn't tell you to save my life all of the things that Russell and I talked about on the way home. But there is one thing in particular that I remember. And it always hurts me when I hear people say, you can't talk to a drunk. You can't talk to a man when he's drunk. You hadn't have talked to me, I might have never been here. But on the way back, Russell told me, he said, Virgil, if you're ever going to find a new way of life, if you're ever going to find sobriety, there are three things that you're going to have to do. First, you're going to have faith in yourself. You have got to believe that you can get sober and you can stay sober with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Secondly, you've got to have faith in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that are in it. You've got to believe that you can work it and that these people will help you. Last but not least, you've got to have faith in a God. You've got to believe that God will help you and furnish you the strength because you don't have it. Russell deposited me at my home at about 4 or 5 o'clock Sunday morning, and I crawled back in my drunk chair. And for 2 days and nights, I sat there and I sweated out this drunk, sitting there looking at a TV set, not knowing what was on it, not caring, just something to look at. And I want to inject here that I have found with most people and practically all alcoholics that no matter where they are, they believe that they're going to find God somewhere else. I sat and looked at that TV, and all of a sudden the word faith came out of it. This word faith seemed to almost leap from that TV set, and as if to say, Virgil, wake up. This is what you're looking for. And I waked up and I looked, and of all things, it was a Yancey Derringer program. There was an old man on there with Yancey, and he had told Yancey he was going out west to find an oil well. And Yancey had asked him how he was going to find it. He said, by faith. Then Yancey asked him what faith was. And the old man replied, with faith was the evidence of things not seen and the substance of things hoped for. I got up out of my chair and went into my den, picked up my Bible that I hadn't had my hands on in 25 years. Without hesitation, I turned to the 11th chapter, the first verse of Hebrews. And there was the verse that this old man had quoted. And I carried it back to my chair and read the entirety of that chapter. And it has more evidences of faith of the characters of the Bible than any other portion. By the grace of God, that was my last drink on the way home from Savannah. I went back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to do my best to work this program, and I wish that I could say to you that from that point on, I became a good alcoholic. But I wasn't. I thought that I had had a real spiritual experience. But I had mistaken the fact that I was still an egotistical, hard-headed Dutchman. Now I went back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to do it the easy way. I began to listen to people say that if you don't like what you hear here, forget it. And I forgot it. And I heard him say that if you don't like the second step, skip it and work the third. And if you don't like the third, skip it and take the fifth. And I was skipping them. I didn't realize that these people weren't staying sober either. And I didn't realize that they weren't helping other people stay sober like me either. But I listened, egotistical. I was going to do it that old cliche, my way. But that's not what the big book says at all. I hear so many people say, oh, I can work this. I can do this my way. I don't have to do it like you do. I can do it my way. That's not what this book right here says at all. This book says, work this program in my way. Not my program, this program in my way. But I was listening to these other people, the easy way out. I stayed around like that for 9 months. And the longer I stayed, the greater the doubt came in my mind till I began to think such things as, my God, Virgil, what do you need with this program of Alcoholics Anonymous? You got sober 10,000 times and you never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you need with this program? I had to learn long time after that that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a place to get us sober. We're really supposed to be sober when we come here, if the truth was known. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program to whereby we can find a new way of life, to where we can be happy without alcohol. But I didn't see it that way. And I almost got in trouble. I looked at the other program and I said, Russell said to have faith in these people. And I've been here 9 months and hadn't any of them found me a job. And this God that he said to have faith in, he hadn't found me a job either. So what do I need with all of this? I'm going to tell you what happened and what I learned later. God did not intend for Virgil to have a job for 9 months. I got sober. My last drink was on February the 5th. All during my drunken days, I had not been a father to my son. This little boy didn't know too much about what a father was. And that spring, after I got sober, he came to me one day and he said, Daddy, I'm going down and I'm going to start playing Little League ball. Won't you come go with me? And I told him, no, I don't think so. I'm busy. I've got to find a job. But I made the mistake of turning around and looking at him, looking him right straight in the eye. And I saw the look in his eyes, and I said, oh, all right, Chuck, I'll go with you. And I went down to the ballpark with him, and he ran on out on the field, and I leaned up against the fence. And as I leaned there, the manager of this team came over and he stuck his hand out and he said, Virgil, you don't remember me, do you? He said, you and I used to play baseball together years ago. And I remembered him. And he says, Virgil, I need a coach to help me with this team. Why don't you help me? And I started telling him, no, Mac, right now, I'm out of a job, and I got to find one. And once again, I turned my head, and there was my little boy looking at me. And again, I saw his eyes. And I told him, all right, Mac, and I hopped over the fence, and I started helping him coach that Little League team. And you know, that first season with that Little League team, we taught the little boys to stand up on the steps of the before each ball game and to put their hats over their hearts and to say the Lord's Prayer. And then the next year, we had them stand on the steps and say the Serenity Prayer. But I worked with him all that summer with those little boys. Then there was an event that happened there one day. Our little boys were looking awful bad playing ball. Mac and I were discussing, standing on the dugout steps, what could be the matter with them. And I felt a tug on my trousers leg. And this little boy looked up at me and he said, Mr. Warren, I can tell you what's the matter with them. I asked him what, and he said, we forgot to say the Lord's Prayer before the ball. And we were in a hurry. It looked like rain. Winter, when my doubts of the greatest. It was one of the coldest winters that we had had in Atlanta in years. Snow and ice was all over the ground. The trees were down and the telephone poles and the power poles were down. Very few people had heat or light. And I began to think, it began to go through my mind about what this little boy had said to me. Virgil, you taught those little boys the meaning of prayer, but what about you? What have you learned? What have you taught yourself? And then that same summer, one of our little boys were headed home from the ballpark on his bicycle. And a drunk came flying down the street in an automobile. He ran him off of the road. He ran into the curb with his bicycle and it flipped him over. And his head hit the curbstone and he was killed. And this little boy's parents, knowing how much that little Jimmy loved Little League, had asked the league for his uniform to bury me. And they graciously gave it to him. And then they went up into the Decatur Cemetery and picked out a lot on the side of a hill. And there they buried little Jimmy overlooking the Little League ballpark. And my mind turned to little Jimmy. I began to wonder if he was cold or if he was warm up in that cemetery. And I drove my car up there as far as I could drive. And I got out and I started to walk. One of the most beautiful skies, blue, the fleeciest clouds. Not a twig on a tree was moving, as if God had set a stage for me. And he and I were the only two living people in that place. I walked down to little Jimmy's grave and I saw where a little dog had run across it. Thought that little Jimmy would like that. And I stood there and I looked out across that ballpark with all the sense of shame and guilt running across me that I had ever known in my life. Here was a little boy, like I had been one time. That had barely tasted of the fruits of life. That I had all of his dreams and all of his ambition, all of his life in front of him. And a drunk like me came along and took it away from him. Drunk that cared nothing about anybody or anything, snuffed it all out. And the realization came to me, Virgil, you can put you a little Jimmy on the side of this hill, too. And you don't have to stay drunk for a month or a week. All you have to do is to take one drink and become qualified. And I know I stood on the side of that hill and I cried with all my heart, oh, God, why can't I find what those people have. I felt God put his hand on my shoulder that day. And he reminded me as I stood there of a passage in Luke. It says that he who sets his hands to the plow and looks back is not worthy of the kingdom of God. And that's what I was doing. I wanted what you people had, but I wanted this mess too, and I wanted to drag it along mine. I was scared, most afraid that I have ever been in my life. You see, I not only was a smart aleck, I was still managing my own life. I didn't need a sponsor. I was handling the situation. Now I knew I had learned enough to know that I was going to be drunk, and I was scared, and I didn't want to be drunk. And I ran to this wonderful man that I had ignored for 9 months. And I sat down across his desk and I said, "Russell, help me. Tell me what's wrong." And I became teachable sitting there across that desk from Russell. And he began to lovingly and caringly and carefully teach me and help me and guide me. And I began to learn what this program was all about. And you know, the biggest thing that I learned, and it shocked me when I learned it, and that was the fact that alcohol, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, won't work. That was the biggest shock that I got out of learning. I want to give you an example of what I mean. You can go down to Sears Roebuck, and you can buy yourself a do-it-yourself kit for a rocking chair. And you can bring it home with you and put it in your living room, and you can lay it out on the floor and sit down on the settee and watch it. And it'll never go together. Never. But you can get up off of your fanny and walk over to that box and open it. And on the inside of it, you will find a set of instructions. A set of instructions of how to put that chair together. And if you follow those instructions like they are numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth on down the line, you can put together yourself a chair. If you skip around on those numbers, you're going to put together yourself a mess. Might not even resemble a chair. But if you follow them in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, you can put together yourself a rocking chair. Then when you get that rocking chair put together, you can start working on it. You can sand it. You can shellac it. You can rub it. You can shellac it some more. You can wax it. So the first thing you know, you have got a thing of beauty. A chair that's beautiful to behold. Then you can sit in that chair and you can rock. And you can find comfort. You can find serenity. You can find happiness. Because you did it. You put it together. You built this thing. It's yours. And nobody on the face of this earth can take it away from you. It's yours. Now, we in Alcoholics Anonymous have a set of rules to a new way of life. The greatest set of instructions to a new way of life that God ever granted the mind of man to devise and put together in one program. And if when we come into this program that if we will get up off of our fanny and open this book and follow the instructions that are written on the inside, the way they are numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4. We can build for ourselves a wonderful sobriety and a wonderful new way of life. A way of life in which we can find serenity and happiness. Where we can be comfortable. Where we can find love. I didn't know what love was. I began to learn from Russell. I was scared one time in AA when I began to look at these people that I had despised and had called hypocrites, and I began to see love in their eyes. And I asked Russell, I said, Russell, what about this? And he smiled, he smiled. And he said, Virgil, you don't know what that is, do you? He said, that is the reflection of your own love that you see. People can't love you until you love them first. And that's the reflection of your love. Russell taught me many things, bless his heart. I told Russell one time that he should have a great deal of gratitude for me, that I made a tremendous AA out of him, that when he got hold of me as a pigeon, that he had to do a lot of research to answer my questions and to help me. But bless his heart, he wanted to. He's up in Sumter, South Carolina now as minister of a church. I'm going to have my next birthday, February the 5th. He's never missed one of my birthdays as chairman. And he called me long distance from Sumter, South Carolina, and he said, Virgil, he says, February the 5th is on a Monday, the 4th is on Sunday. Are you going to have your birthday on the 4th? I said, yes, Russell, I am. He said, well, I've already arranged for a lay minister take my church that Sunday. I'm going to be there to chair your birthday. Wonderful man. I've been talking a long time. I want to put this all together. What I think of Alcoholics Anonymous in close. I've searched a lot of places. Hunted around as to just what do we have? What is it? And why? And how? And what about? And in searching, the best thing that I have found is the parable of Peter and John. When they were walking down the road to the temple, shortly after the crucifixion of our Lord. And on the way down to this temple, they passed a lame, crippled beggar sitting on the side of the road begging for alms. And Peter walked over to this beggar and he reached out and he said, here, take my hand and come walk with us. And the beggar reached up and he took Peter's hand and walked into the temple with him. And the parable goes on that this beggar jumped and leaped with joy at his soundness of mind and body. And when they came out of the temple, all of the Pharisees gathered around and wanted to know, how did you do it? And Peter looked at these Pharisees, and he said, through Christ, through the Christ that all of you have so recently condemned. Now, I was a lame, crippled beggar sitting by the side of the road begging for alms. Alcoholics Anonymous came by. They reached out and says, here, take our hand and come walk with us. Thank God I reached up and took AA's hand and walked with you. And I, too, have jumped and leaped with joy at my soundness of mind and body. And how is this thing? What is this thing all about? Where does it come from? Through Christ, through the Christ that I had so recently condemned. You wonderful people took my hand and showed me the way back to an infinite power, a power that could restore me to sanity, and a power to whom I could turn over my will and my life. You know, I have a thing here that I hear a lot of people say in AA. I hope you don't think I'm a disagreeable person. But I hear a lot of people say, I turned my will and my life over to a God of my understanding. It hurts me. I've read these 12 steps over and over again. I've read this book several times and most of the literature. If any of you can show me in this literature where it says a God of my understanding, I would appreciate you showing it to me before I leave here. And I will get back up on the stage and humbly apologize to each and every one. In the 12 steps, it says, turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. On down in the 12 steps, it says, through prayer and meditation from God. One God. There is only one. These radiators and Christmas trees and back rooms and groups just don't suffice. We tell so many new members, don't, to other people, don't talk to the new member about God. You'll scare him off. We bring him to his first meeting and we sit down and the second word we say is God. We say, you know, we came to this group and we couldn't get on. We stayed sober on the Serenity Prayer for 3 or 4 months. Take this and use it. The first word says God. And then we turn around and say, hey, God, have our understanding. Russell taught me these things, and you taught me these things, and for all of this, I am grateful. Grateful to the point that I pray each day of my life that God will refuse to forbid me of committing the greatest of all sins, that of knowingly refusing mercy to my fellow man. For when I stand before the throne of my God for final judgment, I do not want to say, no, Lord, I didn't help that man, because in my opinion, he's a hopeless drunk. God did not grant to you and I the privilege of attenuated judgment. My God said, the God I understand, whatsoever you do unto the least of these, also you do unto me. What did God, as you understand him, do?